There's a lot to go through. So last week we sort of left off with Jesus essentially asking a crowd of probably thousands, who will follow me? Yeah, two guys kind of say, yeah, I think I will. We don't really hear their answer. But now we're going to see the movement of what Jesus was intentionally doing, because he commands those around, we're going to the other side. We have the movement here. And now Matthew, so the writer of this gospel account, sort of puts together three different accounts. And this morning we're only going to deal with the first two, and intentionally so. But I just wanted to flag with you, this is what Jesus wants his disciples to see after he's asked them to follow him. And so what I want you to sort of think about as we sort of witness these encounters is ask the question, what is it that Jesus wants us to see? What is it he wants us to know about him and what it means to follow him? That's all I want you to do. All right, look with me in verse 23. As he, Jesus, got in the boat, his disciples followed him. So look at that movement. Suddenly, a violent storm arose on the sea, so that the boat was being swamped by the waves. But Jesus kept sleeping. So the disciples came and woke him up, saying, Lord, save us, we're going to die. I don't know if you've ever flown in a plane. I've flown quite a few times now. And sometimes when you're in a plane, you hit these things called turbulence. I don't know the mechanics of the sides. What happens from just coasting in the air, your ship, your aeroplane becomes a roller coaster. That's essentially what happens. That's how I explain the sides of it. I don't often worry about turbulence, though. Maybe because I often watch the sort of air hostesses, sort of, if they're not panicked, I'm kind of like, oh, they're fine. And sometimes the pilot will go on these cones, oh, guys, we're just seeing a bit of turbulence, that's okay, we're just going to go through and last this. If they're fine and calm, typically I'm fine and calm. But if they were running down the aisles with panic on their eyes, and the pilot starts to go, okay, guys, the mask is about to pop out, I think at that moment, the calm for me just leaves. The scene changes. You see, one of the things you probably don't realize about this scene is amongst those disciples who've gone in the boat with Jesus are seasoned fishermen. In other words, they made a career to be on the sea, to know how to read the pattern well enough as they fish for their livelihood. So they know when it's dangerous. In other words, if those guys are panicking in this storm, you should be panicking. It's not just a little bit of turbulence. And the way that the storm is described here is so insightful. It's a violent storm. You think about that word for a moment, violence. Its power is destructive. And in the Greek, it has more of a sense of the waves and the storm being violent. But I think either way, you get this picture that these waves, the storm is out for blood. These waves can destroy, they can kill. They were so big that the water was coming in, almost making the boat indistinguishable from the sea around it. It was so covered that they could no longer see the floor. So imagine for a moment, the sound of storm and wind, just how loud the wind can be. Imagine the waves crashing, pushing and doing violence. You're soaking wet. You're grasping for breath. You can't see the floor below you. You're hitting into things, trying to navigate, trying to hold on, trying to do something in the midst of something you cannot control, leaving you utterly powerless. Imagine the very fishermen that you thought, you guys can sail us out. They're crying out. They don't know what to do. The whole scene is chaos. It's uncontrollable. It is hopeless. And yet in the middle of the chaos, sleeping more soundly than a newborn baby, is Jesus. Now that would have been so ridiculous if the scene wasn't so life-threatening. He matched to the eyes of the disciples. Like he's sleeping. Like he's snoring. Like he, I don't know if he's snoring, but he was sleeping. As though nothing was happening. So the disciples, whether they consciously expected Jesus to do something or not, they actually have really timely words to Jesus as they wake him up. This is what they said. Lord, save us, we're going to die. I have no idea what they expected Jesus to do. But what I do know is they did not expect what Jesus was about to do. They especially didn't realize what Jesus was going to say when he does wake up. Listen, he said to them, why are you afraid? You of little faith. Come on, man. You're soaking wet in the middle of a violent storm. The ship is going down. Our lives are on the line. And you ask us why we're afraid. You call us little faith. Look at the evidence before you, Jesus, you son of a carpenter. Look at how vivid and how real this storm is. Look at how dangerous and lethal it is. Look at the chaos before you. It's uncontrollable, untamable, unmasterable. It's hopelessness. And you ask us why we're afraid. You're unaware to these disciples. There was no safer place in all of existence than in that little boat. Listen to what happens next. Then he got up and rebuked the winds and the sea, and there was great calm. The men were amazed and asked, what kind of man is this? Even the winds and the sea obey. Like, it's, in one sense, it's so hard for us to imagine what it would have been like to have waves, almost as big as skyscrapers falling upon you. It's so hard to even imagine what it would have been like to be on that sort of seas being tossed around. And then all of a sudden, in a split second, it being silenced by the words of the man. Like, this isn't some comic book type of stuff where, you know, you've just made up a superhuman. It's not some sort of Jedi or wizard type thing. You've got to grasp this. Jesus gets up and commands creation itself. The wind and the waves obey his whispers. More than that, they rush to obey it. They move to his pattern, his rhythm, his melody. This isn't man versus wild. It is the wild responding to its creator. These words are more than just words. These words brought existence into reality. These words bring something out of nothing. And look, I don't know if you've ever been to the beach or if you've been to the beach lately. We'll just sum up, we've been there a few times. There's one thing I can guarantee you, we will never master the ocean. I don't care how good a surf you are, I don't care how advanced the technology, you cannot control the ocean. And yet in a split second, Jesus can. He softens creation. He tames the untamed, controls the uncontrollable, masters the unmastered. And say, yes, these men, as they sit there going from to and fro to sight to just calm, are amazed. More than that, they're terrified. And rightly ask, what kind of man is this that even the winds and the sea obey him? Beloved friend, this is no mean man in the boat that the winds and the waves obey him. But here's my question. What's the point of the story? What is Jesus wanting us to grasp at this moment? I mean, imagine giving up everything to follow this guy, and the first thing you encounter is a threatening, life-threatening storm. What is it that Jesus, and it's not that Jesus didn't know the storm was about to hit. He knew. So what is he teaching us? What does he want us to take home from this moment? Can I clarify right now that this, what this scene isn't teaching us? Really clear that trusting in Jesus means it's just smooth sailing from him. Trust in Jesus and your life will be easy. That is not what Jesus is teaching us in this moment. And let me explain why, because you might think, well, aren't we wanting people to follow Jesus? And you just told us that it's not going to be smooth sailing. By this point in the Gospel of Matthew, Jesus already promised his disciples that hardship and suffering await those who follow him. I know that is an exciting advertisement for Christianity, but hear me out. This is what Jesus says to them. You are blessed, his disciples, those who are listening, following him, when they, people who don't like Jesus, insult you and persecute you and falsely say every kind of evil against you because of them. Be glad and rejoice because your reward is great in heaven. For that is how they persecuted the prophets who were before you. And then again later on, Matthew 7, therefore everyone who hears these words of mine and acts on them would be like a wise man who built his house on a rock. Notice, the rain fell, the rivers rose, and the winds blew and pounded that house, yet it didn't collapse because its foundation was on the rock. In both those passages, the implication is that relationship with Jesus will most likely mean persecution and a storm. It's not a matter of if, but when. I love that Jesus never lied to us about what it was to follow. Jesus isn't sailing, follow me, smooth sailing. But if he's not saying that, what is he saying exactly? What type of incentive should we or anyone else have if the ticket he's given us isn't out of suffering and pain and hardship? Well, the guy just calmed creation with words. Maybe let's just hear him out from it. Here is what I think Jesus is teaching his disciples. Rest. Hear me out. Rest. Now, what I mean by that word isn't, you know, better sleep or relaxation patterns. You know, like this is why Jesus is like, here, let me give you top 10 meditation routines to do while a storm's about to hit. That's not what I mean by rest. What I do mean by rest is this. Rest, assurance, and peace. You might be thinking, okay, where do you get that from the text? So let me explain. What do we see Jesus doing in the boat? In the middle of a storm that's about to kill people. Sleeping. Why is that so? Like, nowhere else in the scripture, like in the narratives of Jesus' life, do we have a picture of Jesus was sleeping but here. Why? Why is that detail so important? I mean, Jesus knew they were about to set sail. He knew that they were about to hit a storm. So why does he intentionally sleep? And then notice the question he asks his disciples. What are you afraid of? You have little faith. You have faith, trust. You have little trust. What is it that Jesus wants his disciples to grasp? That to trust in Jesus means you can rest in him. You see, a fake gospel, fake good news about Jesus would say, follow Jesus and life is easy. Jesus is just a means to an end. You know, you follow Jesus, wealth, popularity, you know, all that stuff. Follow Jesus, that is a fake gospel. It's a destructive gospel. The true gospel is, follow Jesus and you get Jesus. You see, to rest in Jesus, to know who holds you in whatever circumstances you're in. To rest in Jesus is to know that the one who holds you is the one that says to you that neither death nor life, nor angels nor rulers, nor things present nor things to come, nor powers nor height nor depth, nor anything in creation will be able to separate you from the love of God in Christ Jesus. You see, rest is the assurance of who is with you and the peace that allows you to hope in whatever circumstance you're in, even in the light of death. As Jacob shared before, Peace is that calm in the midst of chaos. Not because you're ignoring life and just putting it here and that, you know, your fingers in your ears. But because you have someone who is greater than all that you're experiencing. You see, to rest in Jesus is to trust that Jesus is greater than all our realities. That your life is built upon a rock, that when the storms hit, it won't be shaken. That death and suffering will never have the final say. That even death itself is silenced by the voice of Christ. Where is your sting, O death? When Jesus says, you are his, you are his. Death will have no voice. Creation and death tremble before him. To rest is to have assurance in him and to have the peace in the midst of even the greatest of storms. Let me put it this way. Our youngest daughter, Nora. Man, she just has Catherine and I wrapped around her finger. She's a cute little thing. And she knows it, which sucks for the older two. But this little cute thing, like, this is what she does. And often to the frustration of Catherine. So she doesn't sleep, but she wakes up and she has nightmares. There's monsters everywhere. She can hear something outside. She'll come in and Catherine's like, oh, sweetie, I'll take, no, I need daddy. Quiet, we all are. Yeah, that's right. And so often I'll take her back to bed. I lay down next to her. And she goes, look, there is nowhere safer than in daddy's arms. She sits on the strongest person alive. Poor thing, you're 5 foot and breathing. He's bowling. Like, it's like, you know, for now, it's a real good thing. But she'll come out. I'm scared. She'll lay with me. I'll pull my arm down. She puts her head on my arm. And you know, the first thing she does when her head hits my arm. She snores her little head off. Rest. Her circumstance hasn't changed. In her mind, the monsters are still there. It was who was with her in the midst of that changed everything. You see, following Jesus doesn't mean smooth sailing. I guarantee you will eventually hit a storm. But following Jesus is having the assurance that you are never alone. That the one who holds you holds all of creation in his hands. Following Jesus, having peace in the one that commands all creation. Having peace in the midst of the greatest of storms. Even if it's you calling out in fear, save us. The assurance we have is that God doesn't ignore us at that point. Jesus didn't go, oh, you of little faith, you know what? I'm going to go back to sleep. You manage this. What does Jesus do in the midst of little faith as he calms the storms themselves? So can I ask you a question? Who do you have in your boat? If those storms will come, whether you're religious or not, who do you have in your life that will hold you in the midst of it? That has, let me phrase it again, who has the power to hold you? The power to allow you to rest in the midst of it. You see, to rest isn't to ignore the realities around you, but it is to know who you have with you in the midst of it. Which leads us to our next one. Be with me. When he had come to the other side of the region of Gadarenes, two demon-possessed men met him as they came out of the tombs. They were so violent that no one could pass them. Suddenly they shouted, what do you have to do with us, Son of God? Have you come here to torment us before the time? Now, there are a few details that probably need clarifying with this encounter, as I can imagine that there are probably a million questions about it. So let me help by clarifying a few things in my hope that you'll grasp the power and beauty of what is sort of going on. Firstly, notice that they've finally reached the destination that Jesus intended for them from the beginning. Remember? So let's go to the other side. They've hit a storm, they've finally reached the destination. Now, it's not an overly long trip, but it would seem that they landed roughly in that region with the circle. Like, because they didn't have, you know, sort of signposts that lasted 2,000 years. It's roughly around that area. But what is interesting about the destination is that it's a Gentile town. Now, Gentile, if you don't know, just means they were not Jewish or of Jewish heritage. And during this time, Gentiles, in the eyes of most Jewish people, were viewed as unclean, unworthy. You don't associate with Gentile people. So notice, what does Jesus do? He gets in the boat, follow me, hits the storm, calms it, gets to where? To the unclean Gentiles. Just keep that in mind. Second thing to notice is that the author, Matthew, in his gospel is more focused on making his sort of theological point. A point about who God is. Mark and Luke add a bit more flair to that. They add more details. Matthew is very quick in his narrative to make the point he's trying to make. Just notice that if you've gone, oh, wait a minute, isn't Matthew different to Mark and Luke? No, Matthew's trying to make the point. Thirdly, this story contains demons and exorcisms. But this story isn't about demons or exorcisms. It's about Jesus. So you can ask me questions later, I probably won't be able to answer it. Because that's not the point of the story. This story, or this encounter, is as much about demons and exorcism as the last encounter was about sailing and weather patterns. Make sense? I say that because the obvious thing we want to do is focus on the demons and exorcism, and we miss the forest from the tree. But I will briefly say this. Demons coming out of the woodwork wasn't just like a common thing. This is quite extraordinary. You read your Bible, this isn't a commonplace event that just happens. It's not like back then they were just dumb and they just thought, oh, that's a demon, you're a demon, oh, there's demons everywhere. That's not what happens. I would sort of explain it this way, that when Jesus comes into the picture, imagine for a moment a messy room. And let's say you've got a torch and you can sort of highlight bits of and parts of the messy room. You can see some of the brokenness in our world. As you heard Luke and Sam share, we can notice certain brokenness in the worlds that we sort of dwell in. But notice how much darkness there still is through our perception. But when Jesus comes, it's as though the light is turned on. He exposes everything. Demons come out of the woodwork because there is nowhere for evil, for darkness to hide. He shines brightly in the darkness, and the darkness has nowhere to run or hide. That is the point of the story. Jesus comes, and the room is lit up. Which leads to the fourth big detail. That Jesus is referred by none less than the demons themselves as the Son of God. His title is clever, like he used the Son of Man earlier. It is, again, a theological, an understanding of who God is. It's a theological sense. He is showing his divinity. They are acknowledging something about who God is. But typically the term meant the promised one of God. You see, the Jewish scriptures promised that there would be one that would come that would rule forever, and his kingdom would know no end. The King of Kings, the Christ, the Messiah. The demons actually acknowledge this even before his own disciples did. But what's important is their recognition of Jesus. They acknowledge who Jesus is. Now, like, why is that important? Because I think a lot of us like to think that the forces of evil and good is sort of like this yin-yang thing. That somehow the forces of evil are about to fight and the forces of good like a sort of an equal footing. That is not how the Bible depicts God against evil. No, even evil. The darkest aspects of it, these demons, understand they do not stand a chance before Jesus. That these demons were so powerful, so violent, that no human could restrain them. They were so scary that they lived in tombs where dead things dwell. But when Jesus comes, evil is terrified. Which leads me to my last quick point, that evil has a timestamp, an expiry date. You see, what the demons are concerned about as Jesus arrives is they're like, wait a minute, Jesus, it's not time for us to go. You see, we like to think that evil will persist, but the coming of Jesus heralds that one day evil, darkness, will know its end. Like, read the news for a minute. Even if you're not religious, our world is so broken at the moment. From earthquakes in Turkey, wars in Russia, from every moment I read the paper, from all sorts of abuses and corruption in Australia, not some third world country. Our world is so broken and is so evil, and yet Jesus' arrival makes evil tremble before him. The arrival of Jesus heralds that one day this evil will not last. I don't think I have to labor how good of news that is. But either way, I understand that Jesus' coming brings something so powerful that we need to acknowledge it. Okay, well, that's a good. The heart of what's going on. Keep reading verse 10. A long way off from them, a large herd of pigs was feeding. If you drive us out, the demons begged him, send us into the herd of pigs. Go, he told them. So when they had come out, they entered the pigs, and the whole herd rushed down the steep bank and into the sea and perished in the water. Then the men who tended them fled. They went into the city and reported everything, especially what had happened, what had happened to those who were demon-possessed. At that, the whole town went out to meet Jesus. When they saw him, they begged him to leave their region. Now, if you're anything like me, one of the first thoughts I have when I read that text is like, what about the poor pigs? And what about the poor farms? So it's like it's putting your 21st century lens on. You're like, oh, pigs. Like, just for a moment, can you just let the text sort of speak for itself? Firstly, Jesus brings the disciples for the very reason for them to witness what's about to happen. Follow me and let me show you what I'm about to do. Goes into a Gentile region, which for Jews, remember, represented unclean people. Then they encounter demon-possessed people, which once again not only makes these Gentiles unclean, but incredibly unclean, incredibly unworthy. As far as the unclean chart goes, they're just blown. And then on top of that, these demon-possessed men are so unclean, unworthy, that the very people, the very society, community that they live in think they're unclean, broken, they're so twisted by evil that they've given up on them. Everyone despises them, everyone avoids them. And yet there is one person that engages them. Okay, that still doesn't explain the pigs. There are two things that you probably need to know. This is how I love explaining it. This is Jesus loved teaching in parables and stories. Feel like this is a live parable. Jesus is trying to teach them something about who he is and who the demons are. Feel like this is the action version type parable. Firstly, he's showing his disciples that he's more powerful than the demons themselves. And secondly, he's showing his disciples what demons do to humanity. Does that make sense? He's showing them, hey, I have the authority to command evil itself to flee, and they flee. And he's showing them, this is what evil does to humanity. They destroy and kill. The demons destroyed the pigs, which in their eyes is unclean. If you like, unclean Gentile, unclean animal. He's trying to show them, yes, following the pattern of this world, following demons will bring you death and destruction, but following me and evil flees. So sort of like a live parable. But then we come full circle. What about the poor fathers? That kind of explains the pigs, but what about the poor fathers? Here's some things to consider. The town which these farmers come from rejected and ostracized these very men. In the eyes of the people of that town, these men were dead. They couldn't control them. They couldn't master them. So they put them to dwell where dead things dwell. They lived in tombs, a graveyard. Jesus isn't being cruel with pigs, first of all, because Jesus didn't destroy the pigs. The demons did. Let's clarify that. You need to understand, on top of that, that Jesus doesn't just have mastery over creation. He is master of creation. In other words, he owns every cattle, pig, and sheep upon every hill, valley, and pasture. He owns it all. What he is exposing, though, is what he will do with evil. Jesus seeks to overcome evil and liberate people from its grasp. The town of this people, though, chose to ignore and forget about evil. Put these men somewhere where dead things dwell. They are dead. We don't want to deal with them. They're too violent. They're too uncontrollable. And before we have any sympathy for them, remember what they especially reported to the town. It wasn't that they lost the pigs. That was a side note. Yeah, we lost the pigs. But this guy came, made the demons flee, and these guys are now okay. And you'd think they're completely transformed. You'd think the town would come out celebrating. Yay, Jesus! No, they come out trying to kick him out. I think D.A. Carson puts it beautifully when he says they preferred pigs to persons, swine to the Savior. These farmers weren't kind people. But if I was to summarize this whole encounter, what Jesus does by crossing the sea through a raging storm is to show his disciples that he came to overcome evil and darkness and save people at their worst. You see, the disciples would have easily thought, of course these Gentile people have demon-possessed people. Of course these demon men are unclean, unwanted, unloved, unworthy of God. And yet here, God comes into the picture to save these unclean, unwanted, unloved, and unworthy people. Jesus is showing them that he came not just for them, but for people from every tribe, tongue, and nation. That he came for the broken, the sick, the sinful, the worst of us. He came for you and he came for me. He came to overcome evil and liberate us from its grasp. To transform our lives. And here's the thing. If Jesus could master the storms, and he could command darkness out, but could not change my life, then my obvious question is, what's the point of you, Jesus? But here's the thing. He did transform lives. He is good news. He is light in darkness. Friends, you just heard from Luke and Sam. I love these guys. Like, I discipled Luke when he was a teenager. I married them. Do you think that the first thing I think is a good idea, if this news is so powerless, if Jesus can't change lives and can't penetrate the darkness, that my good idea is like, you know what, Luke and Sam, as a church, let's send you to a place where you won't be thanked, where most of your life will be in tension and toil. Where darkness is so thick you can taste it. Where there is no church. That's a great idea, right? If this news is a mess. But if it's true, watch the storms calm. Watch evil flee. And watch lives be transformed. This is who we want. This is who we need. Right.